You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is going to be going out on the 10th of October, 2024. Now today, since I tend to talk about the same few topics week after week, I want to change it up a little bit. Just because something is in the news every day doesn't mean it's not significant. What the media elites think is important versus what reality is are usually two different things. I want to talk about, and this has to do with American foreign policy, as well as Asian politics, a commonly overlooked possible flashpoint for warfare, and that is high up in the Himalayan mountains, and the on-again, off-again war between India and China. Now, the Himalayas, you know, talk about some place where Johnson's Law applies, but this has concerned me for some time. The Himalayan mountains are, of course, a natural barrier between the two countries, but there's also enough valleys to, and going back to the Middle Ages and in the ancient world, a trade routes between the two areas. We're talking about Tibet, Western China, and India. So the game, the rivalry between China and India is taking place to a great extent on that contested border. Borders which, by the way, were largely drawn by the British. You have plenty of transverse valleys and passes of the Himalayas. And you did have, going back centuries, a tremendous prosperity. Now, that was finally ended to some extent in 1962 with the Sino-Indian War, which was a victory for China. And that led to the blocking of some of these trade ties, despite the fact that India is a heavy trade partner of China. Now, there has been improvement between India and China. There are some signs that some of these routes are being reopened, though every once in a while you come across a story of the two sides either trying to shoot each other or, more recently, beating each other up. We'll talk about why they resort to that here in a minute. You have projects like the South Asia Corridor, the Trans-Himalayan Connectivity, the Chinese China-Nepal-India Economic Corridor, and the Trans-Himalayan Economic Zone of Cooperation. All of these are opposed by the United States, since the U.S. is not a part of any of them, nor should it be. But there is a lack of understanding of this environment, not to mention the disputed border, interventions by foreign powers. We'll talk about that in a minute. Religious conflicts and everything else, not to mention the two fairly small countries of Nepal and Bhutan. And Bhutan, more than Nepal, does have something to do with this. But these projects that I mentioned are falling short of expectations, at least for now. I want to go to someone named Aidan Milliff, who wrote a very detailed article in 2020 for the Texas National Security Review. And this is some of why this particular conflict interested me. Now, back 4 years ago, Indian media, which really are the only media that gets talked about in the U.S., there apparently was hundreds, if not thousands, of People's Liberation Army soldiers digging positions on the Indian side of the border, which is called the line of actual control. And that's largely a de facto border. This is in a place called Ladakh, in the western sector of the Sino-Indian border. Now, New Delhi was very slow to confirm any of this, but there are alleged new PLA camps and the destruction of Indian infrastructure in that territory. When I say infrastructure, I'm talking about road building, which is one of the biggest problems here. Now, that short war in 1962, where China came out on top, afterwards, and the most recent serious one was 2020-2021. In fact, in 2020, you had 11 soldiers at least injured at a fistfight at a place called Nakula, which is about 5,000 yards above sea level, or 3 miles. And this makes life very difficult. Patrols are constantly clashing in that tri-junction border. The northeastern Indian state of Sikkim, the little kingdom of Bhutan, and the Tibet Autonomous Region. 2017, and this is still on YouTube, Panglong Lake was another brawl. And that very same year, the Doklam Plateau in Bhutan took place, and that was essentially a multi-month standoff. So you have patrol incursions, road construction, and these seem to constantly reassert themselves. And the one thing they all have in common is that the U.S. is involved in encouraging India to take action. Now, what this Milif seems to suggest, and he gives very good reason for believing it, is that any individual conflict doesn't have a lot of potential to escalate. And partly that's because of the difficulties in high altitude and very harsh terrain that didn't keep full-scale war in the West occurring, the Kargil War in, I think that was 99 with Pakistan, Pakistan-India. So it is possible. Escalation, though, is physically very difficult, but there is still no resolution here. The border is extremely long between China and India, and again, is immediately involved with Tibet and hence the CIA. There's the incentive is that localized instability and spontaneous clashes, but strategic gains are and have been very small. So these conflicts tend to be low level, but again, as the Pakistan-India War of 99 show, it doesn't have to stay that way. Most of the sides here, you know, U.S., Bhutan, India, China, don't think that there could ever be a quick and decisive victory here. But there is a persistence of tensions. Now, operating something like 2-3 miles above sea level, the nature of warfare is extremely different. It takes days to acclimate to heights, that kind of altitude. So the rate of reinforcements arriving may be slower. The risks of going up too quickly are extremely severe. So they call it acute mountain sickness, which is pulmonary edema and cerebral edema. Even ascending slowly just minimizes the risk. It doesn't eliminate it. During the war with China, one of the in 1962, some Indian units, because they were desperate for reinforcements, were sent immediately to Kashmir and Sikkim. And about 15% of those men, very rushed, developed pulmonary edema. And that's normally fatal. Sometimes as short a period as 10 to 12 hours. That means soldiers have to move very slowly and this is part of high altitude training, which, by the way, the U.S. is now involved with the Indian Army, as if there's not enough flashpoints that the U.S. is trying to provoke into a war. Even trucks and air power, helicopters in particular, have to carry lighter loads. Men have to consume more calories. Diesel engines are much less efficient and less powerful at, say, the average is 4,000 yards in the air, so 2.3 miles. Resupply is a massive undertaking. The Argentinian mountain infantry units are instructive in this respect, because not every military power has this kind of training. A single company consumes about 7,000 pounds of supplies in a week, or really 6 days. That's roughly a sea level maximum load sortie for an Mi-17 helicopter, which is the common one in both Indian and Chinese armies. Helicopters have to have lower maximum loads at high altitudes. So a single brigade for a week at that altitude would require 24 trips. Each company would require something like 2 sorties a week. So these conflicts have been very costly and don't involve large numbers of men, at least as of now. Now, the Kargil War is significant with Pakistan, also way up in the mountains, taught them a few things. Rifle rounds, even artillery, rocketry, doesn't fly the same way at that altitude that it does on the ground. In fact, India created the first military helicopter for high altitudes, the Prachand. Artillery batteries have to be remade. Men have to be retrained, even recited weapons. There are reports at, you know, in places where these conflicts have taken place, Sikkim and Ladakh, eyesight changes. Low air pressure can induce corneal distortion, nearsightedness, diminish low light vision, and degrade depth perception. Now, even the plateau, it's not a place where you're going to find a lot of tanks. This terrain is a tremendous challenge, despite an entire war or two entire wars being fought there over the last few generations. This so-called plateau has ridges that rise as high as 4,000 yards, as I mentioned, over 2 miles. So despite the fact that places can be, you know, less than 2 miles of, as the crow flies, distance away from each other, you still have tremendous changes, and it could take a very long time. And Ladakh, they're all very similar in that respect. The Chinese side of this is uphill, and it's a little flatter. Now, where the battle was, the Pagong Lake, is about 4,000 yards above sea level, but you can go as high as 3.5 miles. That's, you know, and very close by. Most helicopters can't fly that high, except for the Indian one. Needless to say, while summer weather is tolerable, winters average between negative 10 and negative 30 Fahrenheit, and very high winds are normal, making it much colder. Things like you saw in the Operation Barbarossa, lubricants freeze and artillery metal can crack. There's landslides and monsoons in places like Arunachal Pradesh, which is controlled by India, but is part of it is claimed by China. Landslides are common, and that place is actually a Tibetan area, but is currently a part of India. And this, of course, is going to shape how any war is going to come about. So that means if tension is going to exist, both sides then have the incentive to make very expensive preparations. There has to be groups of men already acclimated that can be moved quickly to wherever the fighting may be. Now, India has a much larger force there than China does. On both sides, the eastern region, which is Sikkim, or Ladakh, which is a western region. And China has fewer soldiers there, but they've developed a fairly expensive infrastructure to speed properly trained reinforcements. That's why they have fewer men at any given time. China has some training going on in the Tibetan Plateau, and both countries have corps, mountain corps, that are specialized in this kind of very high and very strange kind of battlefield. China has light armor that can move more quickly than India can. India has more logistical difficulties than China does. The far eastern region of this border is Doklam. China may have a substantial force ratio advantage, but they can't hold that for very long. It's possible that India could even attack Chinese reinforcements on the Chinese side before they reach these areas. India does have in place artillery covering all the approaches that the Chinese could use through what's called the Chumbi Valley, which, by the way, historically has been one of the most significant routes between Tibet and India. The training here, and again, the U.S. is now involved in this. You know, they're so overstretched and spread around. But most armies in this respect have a graduated ascent, taking about 10 days to bring men who are already trained in mountain warfare to higher altitudes. Altitude sickness is not fun. And this graded ascent, even for well-trained men, means that you really can't surge an army forward. So once the need for more forces at the border is identified, you can't do much quickly. And no one's going to tolerate, and no army is going to tolerate, this kind of attrition, non-combat attrition coming from these very serious illnesses. Not to mention, everyone has to travel lighter and in smaller groups. So there's no shortcut here. That also means that both sides want to start mobilization more quickly, and they don't want to do it earlier in any kind of crisis. The downhill side is just as difficult, because heavy trucks have to go very slow, move very slowly. So it isn't miles, you know, between two points. It's angles and changes in altitude. Now, the Chinese Army, the PLA, has its Western Theater Command. They have six brigades regularly at altitudes above, well, 3,000 yards, a couple of miles on in the Tibetan Plateau. Now, India has more. Their 33rd Corps, of course, much larger than a division. They have three full-size infantry division, artillery, and is much closer to the Sikkim part of the border than the Chinese. But their division-level garrisons are about 1,500 yards in the air, so not quite a mile. Some of them almost at sea level. So they may have more men, but they're not as well acclimated to these heights and the cold as the Chinese are. Defenders striking first is a problem. The only real issue is to interdict reinforcements on their own territory before they've crossed the border. And in the Doklam Plateau, which was disputed in 2017, the average height is 2.5 miles in the air. So India always has numeric advantages. China has training advantages. And, of course, the two states, Bhutan, which is tiny, Nepal, which is much larger, are constantly going back and forth, attempting to be as independent as possible. Now, the border tensions are caused by the creation of roads. We're not talking about the Belt and Road Initiative, which is the one thing that's drawing India to China. India's relationships with Russia has improved greatly, and the arrogance of the American foreign policy establishment, daring to lecture to the Indians as to what they should do, has done nothing but make the Modi administration more pro-Russian. But whether that means automatically more pro-Chinese is a separate area. So warfare there tends to encourage rapid, almost hair-trigger reaction, because they have to hit hard with what they have available. in the air. And, the Indian performance in Kargil and before then was excellent in the air and on the border. They very rapidly destroyed Pakistan by a naval attack on Karachi, which is a port city, destroying their fuel supplies. And their air force had did very well. Because remember, though, takeoff weights for fight any kind of attack aircraft are inversely proportional to takeoff altitude. So higher airfield decrease payload capacity, not to mention the fuel load. So you have a 10-day window for any kind of mobilization. Although some claim, this writer claims that India has a qualitatively superior mountain infantry, assuming that they mobilize within 24 hours. But regardless, it still takes at least 10 days to get there. But during the Doklam crisis in 2017, forward deployments tend to bring them close to the area, but not much higher. And the gains available are very small. There's also more Indian air assets there than the PLA Air Force. And the Indians has more, both in terms of aircraft as well as personnel. But the PLA Air Force, their ability to search air defense assets, their superior surface-to-air missiles and everything, that will diminish any advantage that India happens to have. So maintaining the status quo, which the U.S. does not like, especially in the Sikkim sector of the Sino-Indian border, it requires destabilizing mentality. Stability means that one side has to rapidly match the other side's mobilization, albeit slowly and with great difficulty. And since they simply can't send large numbers of men at any given time, battles tend to be of low intensity. Again, I want to make an exception for the Pakistan War, the Kargil War, in 1999. So there is a certain incentive to boldness at the tactical level, but it also constrains small disputes from getting larger. The altitude and the terrain impose tremendous constraints for any kind of revision. And revision hasn't been the case, despite now the full American backing for action of India against China in this area. So if the Pakistan War is any indication, these things can, in fact, turn very nasty very quickly, although the Pakistan War was mostly from the air and on the water. And what this altitude suggests is that stalemate is going to be the order of the day for the most part. Now, in Ladakh is where these two forces are facing off, and they have been there for the last 4 years. This is even more severe than in Sikkim. You're talking about a 4,300-yard elevation. It's taken a long time to be acclimated to that. Resupply by helicopter or truck is very difficult and uncertain even during good weather. And while road construction is continuously going on, that's what tends to spark violent conflict there, because road suggests permanence. Now, allegedly, we'll talk about this in a minute, there's news reports that suggest that China has already taken small pockets of territory in Ladakh. And in fact, news reports have recently stated that China has invaded Bhutan, which is obviously not true. But I've seen that in a couple of places now, which is why I had to rush and see what was true and what was false here. Now, the point of all this, and I want to quote from Drago Bosnich, who I've quoted on here 100 times before. This was written in 2003. And this is where people began to notice the American role. Now, despite there being overstretched, losing war, collapsing infrastructure, Navy in tatters, one thing that the U.S. still can do fairly well is your surveillance, reconnaissance capability. And that's, it's been quite underhanded. And the one place that's gone under the radar where the U.S. is stoking these tensions is within this frozen border. Now, the problem is that the multipolar world that Putin speaks about, and Xi speaks about, and the Central Asian leaders speak about all the time, has these two pillars in South Asia, I mean, of India and China. To be an ally of China is not necessarily to be an ally of Russia and vice versa, although it doesn't hurt. Now, BRICS, you know, India is a very important aspect of this. These are two rapidly growing powers, and they continue to do so. And as recent events suggest, India is tiring of the Western arrogance in this respect. This is why the U.S. is so adamant that Beijing and New Delhi remain locked in these disputes, and it's hard to see how either power is benefited by any of it. The U.S. could be ended in Asia with Sino-Indian cooperation. The prospects of that, though, are pretty high. What these claims at the border are at best of negligible economic and political value. They are very lowly, poorly developed. Both Bhutan and Nepal are very low on that scale. It's possible to improve this, but only at great cost. You know, it's their core cities are hundreds of miles away at least. Now, the American media said, the U.S. news report said, the U.S., quote, provided India with unprecedented intelligence sharing during a clash between Indian and Chinese troops in December of 2022 along the disputed border high in the Himalayas, known as the line of actual control. Now, the claim is that the U.S. says that there's a 2020 agreement, the Basic Exchange and Cooperation Agreement, which is meant to provide India with real-time details of China's positions and force strength before a clash would occur on the border. The claim is that the Chinese military incursion is what caused it, and Indian troops were sent to intercept them, but all of this depended on the word of the Americans. They keep talking about satellite imagery, which is not obvious and not self-interpreting, and what they were able to provide, New Delhi, was much clearer and more quickly deliverable satellite images. And this is a very sudden move. The U.S. has not been very closely involved in this, although, of course, they've been very close to the Tibetan separatist movement since it was created. But thanks to Russia, India, and China, over the last few years, have made gestures. I mentioned all of these corridors that they're working on, of course, Belt and Road, to try to bury the hatchet in the Himalayan mountains. And again, this is mostly British colonial border drawing, which also is not self-interpreting. Because of the difficulty of fighting a war up there, sometimes these are mostly fistfights. But because of India's relationship with Russia and the possibility and the continuing reality of peace between the two powers, China and India, the U.S. has panicked a little bit. The U.S., therefore, is trying to drive a wedge between them under the guise of protecting India. And the Pentagon has, with varying degrees of success, tried to build closer tie with Delhi for no other purpose than to challenge the Chinese. And this is where the Quad came from, the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue. Australia, India, Japan, and the U.S., founded in 2007 in Tokyo as an anti-Chinese movement. But New Delhi doesn't really accept that. It's just one force among many. This is an abused organization. And as of a year ago and as of now, U.S. Indian ties are falling apart. The sanctions on Russia opened up India as a new source of Russian oil, Russian manufactured goods. Attempting to turn this Quad into a NATO that would bring together the Indo-Pacific has failed miserably. India has stopped Quad statements condemning Russia's counteroffensive against NATO aggression in Europe and Ukraine. And this is why, as I've mentioned here before, the U.S. had to go to AUKUS, the acronym referring to the U.S., U.K., Australia, existing only to maintain the regime's power in Asia, specific by, again, targeting China, but to a lesser extent, North Korea and Russia in the Far East. The fact that India really wants to stay out of this while maintaining sovereignty and independence and a peaceful course with China is brings about the American stick rather than the carrot, but the stick is of no interest to India. This peaceful coexistence has been at least partially mediated by Russia, because this is the ground of a multipolar world in the most populated areas on the planet. Multipolarity suggests that both nationalism and regionalism should be the dominant forms of rule, or the foundations of these forms of rule, because it stresses sovereignty. Each country is, or each nation, exercises the sovereign right to choose its own path economically and politically, with the exception of being non-colonial. This, of course, is unacceptable as far as the regime is concerned. The regime is only concerned with subservience and rendering developing countries either completely colonized by American corporations or reduced to third world status. This doesn't prevent, though, the U.S. from absolutely and desperately needing New Delhi on its side in all respects, because that's the only way that the Eurasian multipolar world could ever come about. The U.S. could not circumvent that, let alone defeat it. Moscow is the central figure here in bringing China and India closer, and Russia has that capacity. Now, the way that this is developing, the Hudson Institute, actually Geopolitical Intelligence Services, this year, actually, just a few months ago, you know, I've always criticized either private companies that provide international political risk assessment to companies, and they're usually really bad. And this one is no different. This is from Aparna Pandey, obviously an Indian name, talking about this. And one of the things that she notes, and I've come across this too, is that in May of this year, allegedly there are satellite images showing an expansion of Chinese settlements in Bhutan. Very tiny, doesn't have even a million people. Bhutan tends to be independent, although they're close to India in many ways. That doesn't mean that they're anti-China. They also have a state-owned central bank, by the way, with an army of about 8,000. But these satellite images don't tell me anything. Remember, it was just a couple of weeks ago, if that, the New York Times and the Pentagon was talking about a, this is all projection, of course, a failed and sunken nuclear Chinese sub in the South China Sea, where everyone at the time said this is where they're produced. And the production is going very badly, some new nuclear subs, and it's sinking. They claim that satellite imagery shows this. Well, it showed nothing of the kind. First of all, the only place that China produces nuclear submarines is inland, not in the South China Sea. So, you know, it just looked like a bunch of buildings, a typical satellite photo, and there was a shadow in the water. And all these people, the Pentagon, the New York Times, all they said that this is definitely the case. Their nuclear sub-program is going very badly. These new models. And of course, finally, it was revealed that this couldn't be true. This is a shadow. It was made actually by cranes. Shadows being cast into the water. And that is not a place that China makes its nuclear-powered submarines. But everyone was convinced that that was the case. So when these people talk about satellite images showing Chinese military camps in Bhutan, Bhutanese not saying anything about it, by the way, I don't believe them. It's conceivable, but since, you know, all of these countries are very dependent on China for a lot of things, maybe Bhutan less so, It's an extremely impoverished place. You know, I remember the nuclear sub story. I don't think anyone's even retracted that, but this is a common thing as far as the regime goes. And with Modi in New Delhi, the trade between the two powers is growing, and both qualitatively and quantitatively. Now, she seems to suggest that it's the Indians allowing the Dalai Lama and Tibetan refugees to go into its territory this way. Now, that didn't help matters, but that's not the reason that they're opposed on the border. And she's very worried about Chinese naval bases being planned throughout the Indian Ocean, all the way to Africa. So apparently only the Americans are allowed to do things like that. And the only reason the Chinese would do something like that is not so much to challenge India, but because the U.S. has been involved in encircling it. Yet in this typical form of projection, the Americans, always claiming to be the advocate for India, says no, India is being encircled, despite none of these things being being built yet. So these risk assessments, usually in this case, it's very simple-minded, and it doesn't add a lot to the story, but it's somewhat influential because she is at the Hudson Institute, and both countries try to find allies in South and East Asia. But China is the top trading partner of all South Asian nations, including India. So its expansion makes sense. The U.S., of course, does not. More South Asian students go to China for their education than to India. Both pro-China and anti-India politicians have won elections in Nepal, Sri Lanka, and Maldives. That's nothing new. India isn't threatened by this. It makes sense. And it doesn't have to be somehow anti-Indian, unless, of course, you listen to the Americans who try to stoke anti-Chinese thinking in Indian elites. But with Modi in charge, that's falling on deaf ears. Now, during the lockdown, this is in April of 2020, I think India was only, because the economy was completely shut down, so there was no congressional, no legislative or judicial talk about this. They altered their foreign direct investment rules, mandating government approval for investments, companies from border-sharing countries. India, and this really smacks of American manipulation, banned 200 Chinese-made apps, TikTok, many others, for violating India's foreign exchange laws. And the fact that this was done in April of 2020, when the regime shut down the Indian economy, despite it having like 3 or 4 cases at that point, it sounds like American manipulation, or that the U.S. was promising bailout money so long as they do this, because this doesn't make any sense. This is a very American thing to do. And this is just another example about how the U.S. is creating conflict where none exists. And the only way that this would come at the expense of India is if the American point of view was taken seriously, which increasingly it is not. So it seems that, you know, there's been a recent color revolution in Bangladesh, used to be called East Pakistan. Just like Erdogan in Turkey, don't be surprised at the possibility of a color revolution in India too, and the ascension of a vehemently anti-Chinese Indian movement. I think that would be very difficult to pull off, but it's very possible. Anyway, thank you everyone for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.